You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon and welcome to The Weekend. And join us today on The Weekend are Mary Benanti and Dr. Tony Payan. Mary is a retired journalist, although I don't want to say you're a retired journalist because you're always writing, right, Mary?
You're always writing. You never stop.
And Mary worked as a journalist in Washington, D.C. for many years. She worked for Gannett News Service. And she taught at New Mexico State University and is still teaching at New Mexico State University. And so we're going to talk with her and also Dr. Tony Payan, who is a professor at Rice University at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy. Tony, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back here, even if virtually, at my former institution, UTEP.
And as we're talking, of course, I'm not sure if everyone is as shocked. And so we want to talk a little bit about what happened in this election that everybody, supposedly the pundits, the pollsters, and that includes you, Tony, and Mary as a journalist as well. We're going to cover it from both sides and just as Americans as well. Let's start with you, first of all, Tony, as a professor of political science and working at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy. Tell us a little bit about what goes on behind some of these polls and exit polls and everything else that you have worked with in the past and continue to do so.
Well, in the past, I think polling was relatively accurate. And I'm not talking about the 1930s and 1940s. I'm talking about, you know, the 1960s and on, when everybody had a phone line and there were fixed lines and everybody could call in and people could give answers. And there was a lot of faith in government and there was a lot of trust in politicians and so on. And people were not afraid to express their political opinions and they essentially answer the questions. But, you know, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, we began to see essentially these lines fade away, a more acrimonious political environment people perhaps not being completely honest, and the rise of cell phones that have privacy standards that are different than fixed lines. And then, of course, we ourselves do not seem to have adjusted very well to the way we do polling. We're just not doing shoe sole political science. And, of course, many, many of us failed to predict what happened and, you know, the animus, the kind of environment that was going on. I think we need to go back to the drawing board as a discipline and figure out exactly how we're going to take the pulse of an electorate before any election.
And joining us, as I mentioned, as well as Mary Benanti. Mary is a journalist. And Mary, let's take it from your point of view. You as a journalist covering some of these pollsters and some of these pundits. Give us your take on what happened Tuesday night.
Well, let me first say that I was shocked but not surprised. I think when you are a journalist and you are covering politics, especially if you're from Washington, D.C., nothing should really surprise you. But we can continue to be shocked but not surprised. I think that one of the things that we have to look at is where and when the polls began to go up and when and where they began to go down. I do think there are several problems. Number one, I think social media has obscured a lot of what maybe pollsters and pundits have relied on in the past. In other words, people are looking at their Facebook first thing in the morning. They're not turning on the news. They're looking at Facebook and they're sharing. That information may be true or false. In fact, today's journalists could spend a whole career doing fact-checking on just what shows up in fake news on the social media. The second thing is I do think that maybe the pollsters are being a little hard on themselves. Maybe the Comey thing was a bigger hit on undecideds than many of us realized. The last-minute announcement by the FBI, the way it blared out across social media first and then the major news organizations, and then the major news organizations have to kind of roll back and say, well, the case was not reopened. They just found more emails and so on and so forth. Well, by the time that all got cleared up, a very good, interesting thing that happens in Washington, D.C. is if you want to be able to put out some news that you don't want to have to answer questions on, you put it out on Friday afternoon. And then everybody in Washington goes home. And the news reporter is then busy calling all of their sources. So I think when you, as a pollster, Tony, look at some of the history and how the polls are done, I think you need to look at the dips and turns and what might have really affected those polls in the last week.
Yeah, that is true. However, we also, again, we need to do a little bit more qualitative analysis.
Absolutely.
On the mood of the people and what exactly is going on in their minds. Because if you look at the electoral map, the failure of pollsters is actually very focalized. It's not general. One of them was in the turnout. Less than or about 120 million people turned out. This is a very low turnout because the population is growing, and this is a turnout that looks a lot more like the year 2000. It's already 2016, number one. And as you know, the failure was exactly in the Rust Belt. This was Hillary Clinton's firewall. This
Absolutely.
Was the place where she was going to get the most, or at least a good chunk of electoral votes, and that's exactly where we failed. So, you know, Florida was a toss-up all the time. North Carolina was a toss-up. Virginia was a toss-up. They were somewhat close, and of course, other states were well predicted, New York and California and so on. It was that area, and I guess our instruments were just not fine enough. They were not really effective in measuring exactly how he was making a breakthrough in exactly those states. We just completely misread them. So even geographically, I think there was a failure. So in that sense, I'm not self-flagellating. I think that, you know, it was a close election even to the end. The polls were well within the margin of error, but I think we misread that particular region of the country.
Now, so Tony, we kept hearing in the media, and it could have been, you know, false reports, as Mary was mentioning also, that there were numbers, record numbers of people turning out to vote. And what you just mentioned, that we had 120 million voter turnout, which is not very high, as you mentioned. Which way did it go?
Well, here's, I think, where the Democrats got in trouble. Trump enthused just enough of his supporters, people that were unhappy with the system, with trade and with the way the country is going culturally. So he seems to have enthused just enough people that turned out to vote. And then the Democrats just did not get their base out. They obviously failed, because if you think about Barack Obama at his peak, I think he pulled 67 to 68 million voters. And Hillary Clinton, I think, barely touched 60 million people. So there is a number there in just 8 years, 4 to 8 years, of between 8 and 10 million people on the Democratic side that simply just did not find it that morning to get up and then take a couple of hours and go out to the polls. The Democratic machine failed, and the polls in the end, you know, may not have been wrong. They just simply measured the level of enthusiasm pretty poorly. A lot of Bernie Sanders were not necessarily convinced, and maybe Hillary Clinton was not able to get these millennials out.
I think that that's probably correct. And I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you as a pollster, how much do you look at what's going on in the media as far as the candidates? Does that feed into anything that you're doing when it comes to polling?
Well, it does. I mean, the one problem about the media is that social media in particular, because I think the traditional media is now very isolated. There are silos. I mean, if you're a liberal, you're probably watching MSNBC. If you're a conservative, you're watching Fox. And so people tend to isolate themselves. This is one of the great breakdowns in American democracy, that we no longer watch these general TV stations, NBC, ABC, CBS, that try to strike the middle and then allow a lot of room for the viewer to make up his or her mind, the viewer is exposed to different points of view. Now we have all this specialized media, and people don't have to listen to the other side. They can just get their own points of views reaffirmed over and over. In the case of social media, though, it is being used very differently because that is, I think, where most of the antagonism is moving to. That is where people are expressing their radical ideas protected by the First Amendment, of course. But you see a lot of just acrimonious speech in the media. And then personally, for example, I thought about a week before I just wanted to tune out. I just didn't want to see any more Facebook postings and then Twittering and so on, because I just felt that it was just a place to go and fight. Even among families and friends, it was just a place to fight.
Yes, I think you're correct there. And I do think that the problem is we are losing that middle ground in the media, where we do have the extreme right, we have the extreme left, and instead of being able to receive information that might look more deeply into an issue or a topic, you are just looking for whatever appeals to you, right, agrees with you, and it doesn't allow for actually independent thinking on the part of the voter, because you have gotten into a queue and you are in that queue and you are listening to an echo chamber.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the media is a business. And one of the problems has been the downsizing of newsrooms. That was something that Walter Cronkite talked about. First, we lost our international reporters. That was too expensive. Then we began to lose different beat reporters, so that we began to rely more and more on big media from the West Coast or the East Coast, but not from Middle America. What you have then is you do have an elite class, and they don't understand what's going on in Middle America, and Middle America is only getting one or two stories from some wire service that points them in this direction or that direction. I will look at this morning's news. Yesterday, Trump met with Obama. It was a nice 90-minute meeting, whatever the time frame was. That's the story that everybody's going to get. They're not going to get a story that says, oh, by the way, the Russian ambassador has now said that they have been in contact with the Trump campaign. Well, some reporter would love for them to tell me, okay, exactly what's going on with that. We are not getting anything but the veneer, just the veneer. And we don't understand on the East Coast what's happening with Middle America and how tragic it is for middle-class families to not be able to send their kids to college. And we can look at that as an elitist media and say, well, they're just whiners. And, you know, here on the East Coast, we do this or we do that. I know when I was in Washington, D.C., reporting for USA Today as a loner, one of the big things about USA Today was, let us not Potomacize the news. Well, unfortunately, that's what it is.
And, you know, there's something else, I think, that we're beginning to see, and I think this is where political scientists need to do more than just polling. There is a cultural shift in the way we view data. I mean, the one thing about today is that we rely on more and more data, and we exalt data in our daily lives. What are the hard facts? What is the truth? What is the, you know, what is the number? How much does it cost? How much does it measure? And so on. And yet, we're beginning to see that there are enough people out there that simply do not care. You may tell them the number. You may tell them that this there are so many dead people. There are so many people who cannot pay college for college. There are so many people, so many fish that are dying. There are so many polar bears and so on. You may tell them exactly the numbers, and it doesn't really matter because everything is filtered through an ideological eye and in a very selective way, cognitively blocking out the importance of the data and just simply standing your ground on an ideological basis. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. If we cannot agree on the basic facts, on the hard numbers, then it's going to be very difficult to reach a consensus. And of course, what we are seeing is that it's going to become even more difficult to do public policy that actually resolves real problems.
Let me once again introduce our guest, and that's Mary Benatti, a journalist who has worked with Gannett News Services. She has worked in Washington, D.C., and she's also taught journalism at New Mexico State University. Dr. Tony Payan, one of our former political science professors here at UTEP, now working at Rice University at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy. One of the things that you both mentioned, Tony, you and Mary, and that is the fact of how, what people were thinking and the fact that some people may not care, may not even understand what the politics are, just whatever's on their Facebook page in the morning and what it is when they close down. And this election, it seems like it started from the word get-go that Trump was about the wall and Hillary was about the emails, and that's all people talked about. And then you have people like you said, Tony, who say, well, I don't care, nothing's going to change. And then it was an election of the lesser of two evils, and I'm not even going to vote.
Yeah, I think this is one of the greatest political and social problems of today, that we seem to have staked out a particular position, and we made up our ideological minds, and every single fact, every single data that somehow runs into our face against what we believe, we're just simply going to dismiss it. And I don't know how you can build a true democracy and a dialogue between two parties and get to the table and actually negotiate something on the basis of facts, even though you may have your interests and you may have your vision of a particular issue, but here are the facts that support it. I don't think that is that matters at all. And then I think that there is also a generational divide. I mean, the young people, the millennials, for example, there's 80 million people, and I'm not sure right now at this point, I haven't seen the numbers on the millennials themselves and how they voted. They seem to have voted overwhelmingly Democratic. But there's also one thing. There's a lot of people on the East and the West Coast, many of us, I think, who are more educated and more liberal, and we kind of get into our own plane, and then we're not thinking about the worker, the high school graduate in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, and Ohio and Iowa, the farmer and the individual in middle America, that is experiencing a lot of economic turmoil, a lot of, they're being buffeted by the forces of globalization, and then we just don't think about them. You know, we think about the coasts, we think about our own reality, and as a friend of mine put it, you're just a bunch of liberal snobs, and you're not hearing that person in the middle of the country, the one that Mary was talking about. You're not listening to them. You're not trying to figure out what exactly they're thinking and what their problems are and how to solve them. And I think this is a problem. And look, I consider myself somewhat of a liberal, but that particular comment made me think maybe I am not listening to these people. Maybe I'm not engaging them. And of course, Trump was able to read them well, take their pulse, and tell them a few sound bites that somehow soothe their economic pain, and then they turned out for him, and that's what made the difference in the Midwest.
And that's true. And here's the other thing about that, Tony, is that people hear different things. When liberals hear Trump talk, he comes across as a racist. We're going to build a wall. Mexican immigrants are rapists. Black lives, it's all lives matter, not Black Lives Matter, et cetera, et cetera. When conservatives hear Trump talk, they're hearing, oh, bad trade deal, open market, jobs, more jobs in the Midwest. And what's really interesting is that when Trump went to Flint, Michigan, he kind of was rebuffed by the city. They said he was there for a photo op. Well, photo op or not, Clinton sat there for how many days and went there at least very early in the crisis. It did not register for some reason. But Trump's being there somehow, probably with his message, it registered with those voters. And it's just like we are saying things to each other and about each other, but we are not hearing each other and understanding each other.
Well, we're usually just yelling and shouting over each other. And this is, I think, one of the major problems that a Trump presidency is going to face. I think that Trump is not necessarily somebody who can change. He's a 70-year-old man who's used to having all the spotlight unto himself. We know during the campaign he was very good at not fading out, and as soon as the spotlight went somewhere else, he said something incendiary and then brought the cameras and the microphones back onto him. And I think that's the way he's going to govern, because that's the way he is. And I think it's going to be an impressionistic presidency, full of these kinds of acrimonious statements. And he's to be a disciplined individual who's carefully listening and who is going to try to strike the right tone and say the right words. And in that sense, I think Obama will be missed, because he may not have agreed with the Republicans or with a lot of different people in the country, but he I think there was only one time when you saw in his face a little bit of impatience, a little bit of annoyance. But even then, he would not say the wrong thing. He would always be so disciplined and say the right thing and try to strike that conciliatory note, and he just did it in the meeting with President-elect Trump. That takes a lot. I don't think Trump is that kind of person. And so we're going to see the protests, we're going to see the resistance, and we're going to see all these kinds of issues for 4 years.
I agree. And I think this is going to present a huge problem for the media. The media is going to have to step up to the plate. I think early on in Trump's climb to first the nomination and then to the election, the media treated him like a billionaire reality TV star, and they kind of sloughed off some of the crude things he was saying. They put him on the air, but they didn't take it seriously. They didn't go and say, okay, Trump says he wants to build a wall. Let's go to Congress and see who among the Republican Party, who among Congress is going to back appropriations for a wall, and how is this going to play out? It was just put it out there and, you know, maybe be amused by it. As he began to gain more and more strength as a candidate, one of the top editors at CNN was commiserating, I guess, with himself and saying things like, well, we gave him too much free publicity at the beginning. So then you saw the media kind of shift and try to take it back. Did they do it too late? How much of this kind of treating one candidate as a political reality, which would be Clinton or Jeb Bush, and then treating another candidate as a billionaire TV reality star and not focusing on the gut political realities, how much of that has played into all of this? So I think as we go forward, we have seen through the fact checkers and even through our own research that Mr. Trump has lied consistently much more than many politicians have. It's going to be up to the media if they really want to be what I, as a journalist, went into journalism for, the first draft of history, to get out there and be a little stronger, be a little more assertive, and be more aggressive. We've already seen Trump try to say, well, no, the press pool's not going to accompany on my tour through the Capitol or the White House. That's a lack of transparency. And the media is now faced with something. Are they responsible for Trump? Probably not. But did their failure help to promote the presidency or a candidacy of someone who has now lost the popular vote in this country? So we have two problems. Not able to understand middle America and understand the pain that millions of our fellow citizens have been suffering. And the inability of the media to check itself and say, what is my role here? Is it to get the 30-second soundbite, get the revenue, and get the popularity, or am I going to be the first draft of history? I think it's a very important question for the media to ask itself.
I wish I could agree with you, Mary, on one thing, that the media will have the capability or the will to step up to the plate and become analytical and critical and sober and interesting and offer a perspective to us, the citizens, the voters, and so on. I'm afraid that that's not the case. I often see the media as kind of a river in the Amazonian jungle, like piranhas that just, you know, they see a body and they quickly go in there and bite and bite and bite, and they get into a frenzy, and then another body gets thrown in there and they go out there, and there's no rationality to it. There is no time to digest things. I'm reminded of that movie, Spotlight.
Exactly.
Where there was a deliberation and there was a journalist who wanted to get the news out now, and the top boss and the journal said, wait, you have to wait. We have to verify the data.
Exactly.
We have to construct the story. We have to do, there's a disciplined coverage to this. Well, that is, I'm not sure that the media today is capable of doing that.
Well, that's my challenge. That's what I said. That is the challenge the media is facing.
True.
And if it wants to continue to have an important role besides just another business that is accumulating revenue by ads, then we need to push them and say, this is what we want. Let us look at this one fact. Yeah. We are the consumers of media. What do we want?
Yeah, I think we've lost the perspective. The media, actually, has lost the perspective that they are a special kind of business. They're not a business that ought to be focused on the bottom line. The media is a business that has a huge responsibility in the maintenance of society and democracy and politics and so on. They've completely forgotten that. It went by the wayside, and now it's all about making money, about cutting, as you said, reporters and bureau chiefs and so on. And then what happens there is that we see a particular news, and then they repeat it over and over again. I often face that because, and I have to be very careful with what I say in the media sometimes, because when I talk to a reporter, very often that same quotation appears in different mediums. It gets passed on. If AP, for example, picks it up, then it'll be in a number of newspapers. And often I feel that, look, that's not exactly what I meant. That's not exactly what I wanted to say. But that's the way it was interpreted. The note needed to be put out now. I was interviewed 2 hours ago. The note is already out, and I'm not even sure they checked. If I gave a number,
exactly,
I'm not sure that the journalist took the care to say, Dr. Payan, there's another number. What do you think about that? No, the story's out.
Well, let's go back to Journalism 101. You don't come back to the newsroom and dump your notebook. You don't just come back and take your notebook or your cell phone, if you got it all on tape, and just run it out there without checking the facts, et cetera, et cetera. But I will go back to when the Supreme Court was deliberating Obamacare. And you could look at what happened with CNN and Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Blitzer was firstest with the mostest, but it was the wrongest. He said that the Obamacare had been overturned. No, it was the one part of Obamacare. Who got it right? Megyn Kelly at Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, where does it start? Does it start with education? How do we make a whole cultural shift about people who really want the truth as opposed to just an echo chamber of their own thoughts? We could talk about this for about 4 hours, and we would never cover the whole topic.
Let me just say something very quickly in 15 seconds. I used to have an art professor when I was an undergraduate, and he told us, look, the facts remain the same, though the truth may vary. I wish the media gave me the facts, and then they allowed me the ability to come up with my own understanding of the facts, and that's not the case today.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to hear your voice again, and I'm sure we'll be speaking a lot more, especially under this new presidency.
My pleasure.
We've been visiting with Dr. Tony Payan, who is a political science professor at Rice University, the James Baker Institute for Public Policy, and also Mary Bonatti, who is an associate professor at New Mexico State University. She has taught journalism there, gender studies, women in journalism. She's teaching here at the University of Texas at El Paso in the OLLI program, the history of elections. And she also worked as a journalist in Washington, D.C., worked for Gannett for many years. And so, Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.